Well, if we may slowly start, take your seats. Well, good evening and welcome. Two preliminary remarks before we get the business underway, and one barely relevant, but in the spirit of Ralph Miliband, the second more relevant. The first is, are there any Americans here in the audience? Any Americans from Boston? Congratulations. For those of you who don't know, an extraordinary history is finally on the side of Boston, on the side of the Red Sox, who scored a historic victory over the Yankees yesterday. This is hugely important for those of us who've been and spent time in Boston and been to see the Red Sox. But we're hoping, in the spirit of Ralph Miliband, this is a sign of things to come. And this, the phrase which doesn't ring off the tongue, Boston rules, might still have some historical meaning in early November. So let's hope that the Red Sox have paved the way. The second preliminary remark is on last year's Miliband lectures. It may seem odd to refer to them, but we had a stupendous collection of lecturers on American power in the 21st century. It sort of connects to my first remark. And these included quite a glittering array of figures: Michael Cox, Michael Mann, John Eikenbury, Joe Nye, Robert Kagan, Robert Cooper, and many others besides, and some from China and the Middle East and so on. Now this set of lectures is available as American Power in the 21st Century. The book has just come out. It's the second in the Miliband series to be published. The first was called Taming Globalization. It was on economic globalization and global governance. This, American Power, and there will be eventually a book on inequalities, old and new. Which brings me to our speaker this evening, John Hills. John, in case you don't know, is, although highly unlikely given the audience, is Professor of Social Policy and Director of the ESRC Center for the Analysis of Social Exclusion here at the LSE. His research interests are wide, including income distribution and the welfare state, social security, housing, and taxation. He is a member of the Pensions Commission, which produced its first report, in case you missed the numerous headlines of the last couple of weeks, this month. He's worked in many places, including the Institute for Fiscal Studies, the House of Commons Select Committee on the Treasury, at the Department of the Environment, among other places. He has, of course, published widely, too long a list for me to even begin to read, and too late in the day for you to want me to read it, but I'll highlight just a few publications. Understanding Social Exclusion, 2002, Private Welfare and Public Policy, 1999, The State of Welfare, 1998, New Inequalities, 1996. But he's here this evening to speak on the themes of his new book, published, in brackets, exclamation mark, coincidentally, today. In his new book, John examines trends in inequality in the UK, how the state affects distribution through its spending programs and through taxation, and what the public thinks about these matters. The new book analyzes the dramatic widening of the UK income distribution since the end of the 1970s, the growth of poverty, and the factors which impinge on these developments. And he also focuses centrally on how government policy affects distribution in very significant and innovative and rigorous ways. Nobody is more qualified in the UK, in my view, to speak on these themes today. So please join me in welcoming Professor John Hills. A little technology help needed.
Which? Okay, I've got it. Right, well, David, thank you very much for those kind words, and also for inviting me to give the lecture here this evening. It's very kind of you to mention some of my previous publications. I have to say that I was told last night that one of those, The State of Welfare, is currently on offer on eBay for 99 pence. However, that was the first edition, so maybe its time has gone. What you said, David, was very kind, but the last lecture in the series was given by the school's former director, Tony Giddens, and one of the things that David was able to say about Tony was that his textbook Sociology has sold 1 million copies. I'm rather hoping that this will rub off. So can I give a very warm welcome to those of you who are from my 997,328 new readers, but also a very warm welcome back to my loyal 2,762 readers. Now, I'm hoping that as a result of this evening's lecture, you're going to carry away four images with you. Well, actually, I'm hoping you're going to carry away a copy of the book, but as well as that, I'd like you to just focus your minds and remember these four images. The first is, as I'm sure you'll recognise, St. Basil's Cathedral in Moscow. Second one is two men of the moment, perhaps rather hoping that one of them will no longer be a man of the moment in a rather short time. An album by the late Ian Dury, and a piece of Gothic horror. So that's what I'm going to be talking about this evening. So sorry if you've come here expecting something rather different. Let me go back to the first of my four images. Really, the focus of part of my book is on what I think I would describe as the what Britain has become, the onion spire society. If you look at the you look at St. Basil's there, you'll see a shape which has a bulge containing most of the mass of the spire at the bottom, and then higher up, spires that disappear off into the clouds. And it seems to me that that is a very good picture of what's been happening to income distribution in the UK, and even more so in many respects in the USA. It has a bulge in the middle where most people find themselves. The bottom is actually, in Britain, now being squeezed up towards the middle, but a small number are part of the spire that is now disappearing off into the clouds. Now, a more conventional view of income distribution, if you like, the onion spire sliced in two and set on its side, is the familiar density distribution of the British income distribution. And this is drawn from the ONS, from the DWP, Households Below Average Income series, and you'll see the higher the bars, the more people are grouped around that income level. The median income, half of the population are below here, a median income level after tax, adjusted towards what it would be like if you were living in a family of just two people, a couple living with that income. Back in 2001-2, a median income of £311 per week to take home. Off on the right-hand side, you'll see the 10th decile group, in fact, disappearing off the edge of the diagram, with 1.5 million people living in households with equivalent income of more than £1,000 per week. And then at the bottom on the left, you'll see just under 20% of the population living with an income for a couple, of just under £190 a week. Now, one of the things that runs through the evidence, which the book does go through, is that people are not necessarily very well informed about where they stand in the income distribution. So just to give you a quick recap on that, a single pensioner receiving only the state pension, which was £72.50 in 2001-2002, would be well within, in other words, in the middle of the bottom tenth. But to get into the top tenth, a couple, each earning £22,000, in other words, each on median earnings, working full-time but with no children, would just be on the fringes of the top 10%. And a couple who had joint earnings between them of only £57,000 would find themselves on the fringes of the top 5%. So to get into the top, to the top tenth or the top fifth, the top 5%, you don't necessarily need very high incomes by comparison with those of many professionals. Of course, the top 10% has got 6 million people in it. By the way, if you're more interested in that, the Institute for Fiscal Studies runs on its website something called Where Do You Fit In? If you go onto the Institute for Fiscal Studies website, you can find where you would be in the income distribution if you want to either cheer yourself up or depress yourself. Now, this distribution is, as I'm sure very well known, much more unequal than it used to be. This shows an index of the growth of inequality in Britain since 1949. The index shown is on two different scales because this dashed series here is an older series calculated in a slightly different way, but it's adjusted to be at the same level. Is an index of known as the Gini coefficient. If the distribution was completely equal, then the Gini coefficient would have a value of zero. If Bill Gates or some UK equivalent had all the money, which obviously he's trying to, the index would have a value of 100. And what you'll see is that this index grew, inequality grew in Britain by 10 percentage points between the late 1970s and the early 1990s. Now, to give another idea of the scale of that, that took Britain across two-thirds of the international range, if you look at industrialized countries. We went from being a somewhat more unequal country than the Netherlands, for instance, to being almost as unequal a country in income distribution terms as the USA. Now, this index is reflecting what has happened to the shares of income that different kinds of people receive. Continuing just for a moment with the households below average income series, the official series, it shows that between 1979 and 2002, the share of the bottom tenth fell from 10% to 8%, and the share of the whole of the bottom half fell, I'm sure that's the bottom 20%, sorry, the bottom 20% fell from 10% to 8%, and the bottom 50% fell from 33% to 27%. At the same time, the share of the top tenth rose from 21% to 28%. In other words, today the top tenth receive as much income, in fact slightly more, than the income received by the whole of the bottom half put together. And this is a development that gathered pace over the 1980s. But what's particularly interesting is to look within the top tenth. And some of you will have been at a lecture given here earlier in the year by Tony Atkinson from Nuffield College, Oxford, formerly of LSE, who has done some remarkable work looking back at tax records over the whole of the 20th century. And he presents a picture of what's happened at the very top of the distribution. This isn't adjusted for household size. There are some discontinuities in the series. But basically, the picture back in 1937 was that the top tenth got 36% of after-tax income, and the top 0.05%, the top half of a tenth of a percent, got 2.4%. Now, that changed significantly after the war, and indeed those shares of the very top fell very considerably by the late 1970s. But almost all of that change has now been reversed, and the slide does not like showing me it. Okay, there we go. That now has the bottom line on it. That picture has now been, as far as the top tenth is concerned, almost entirely reversed. The share of by 1999, the share of the top tenth was as great as it had been before the Second World War. And the same is true of the top 0.05%. In other words, of the top 30,000 people in the country are now receiving 2.4% of all post-tax income. Now, what that means is that if you look at what's happened to the growth in income, to the shares of national prosperity as it's grown since 1979, for every £100 increase in total income, £40 went to the top tenth, £17, a sixth, went to the top 1%, £13 went to the top half a percent, and £5 in every 100 went to the top 1,000th. Now, you can have views of whether that's a good thing, a fair thing, or not, but I just want you to think about the scale of it. If you take a straight Rawlsian position on this, that your only interest is in benefiting the welfare of the people right at the bottom, I think the question you have to ask is, has this been a good deal? Is the country, for instance, a sixth better off than it would have been if we hadn't arranged affairs so that 17% of the growth went to the top 1%, or indeed that a 20th of the growth went to the top 1,000th? Now, why has this happened? One of the factors driving it, but obviously only one of the factors driving it, is what's happened to earnings. Earnings are just one component of people's incomes. There are other things that go into it as well, and it matters whether you're in a couple and married to somebody else who's also on a high income. But clearly, one of the things that has driven that overall change in income distribution is the way in which earnings distribution has widened. Back in the late 1970s, with a mere three times median income, in other words, merely three times the income of the typical worker, you would be in the top 1%. Today, you have to have nearly five times the income of the typical worker to be in the top 5%. In other words, you have to be on around £125,000 a year or more. And to get in the top 0.5%, you have to be on six times that figure, about £150,000 a year. So within the top tenth, and this is really my point about the spire at the top of the onion, it's not necessarily the top 10% as a whole, it's within the very top that a lot of this change has come. But at the other end of the onion, in the last 7 years, people at the bottom have begun to catch up with the middle. And this is my point about the bottom gradually being pressed up towards the bulge in the middle. It's not a simple picture recently of the distribution stretching between all points of it in the way it used to be in the past. This shows, again, using the HBAI statistics, the concentrate on the solid line here. This is the proportion of the population with less than half of less than 60% of median income, looking back to 1979. And you'll see that that rose through the 1970s and 1980s, peaked in the early 1990s, wobbled a bit through the 90s, and is now beginning to fall. And you see that even more clearly if you look at what's been happening to child poverty. Child poverty in relative terms, again the solid line here, is significantly down in terms of numbers over the last 6 years. These figures only run up to 2002, 2003. And the modelling work of the kind I'm about to show you suggests that that we're just about on target to hit the government's aim of reducing child poverty in these kind of terms by a quarter between 1998 and 2004-05, the year we're in at the moment, but of course which we won't really know about where we are now for another 2 years or so. So the bottom is moving up towards the bottom, towards the middle. But one of the other features of recent years, of the last quarter century, that's very striking when you start looking at the data, is that it's become harder to move out of the bottom if your parents don't start off nearer the top. This is work done by Joe Blandon, Stephen Machin, and colleagues in the Centre for Economic Performance here at LSE. And it's just a small part of their results. In this case, I'm showing daughters' earnings. We have information on two cohorts of people, one group born in March 1958, another group born in different dates in 1970. And this shows the link between what your parents' incomes were, going down on the left, concentrating on the bottom quarter, and it should say the top quarter here, and where you end up in terms of the daughter's own earnings when she was age 30, in fact, in 32, later on. And you'll see that 35% in that earlier cohort, people now approach in their late 40s, rather than the 25% you'd expect at random, ended up in the top quarter. But the links are much stronger when you look at those born in 1970. Now you'll see that 40% of those who were in the whose parents were in the top quarter now end up in the top quarter of their own earnings. And conversely, if your parents were in the bottom quarter of income, a third of those daughters end up with in the bottom quarter. And what seems to be happening here is that the influence of education has become stronger. If you look at, well, who ends up where, it does depend more on where you used to be, on your educational qualification levels. Now, that, of course, can be described, as Michael Young did back in the late 1950s, as the rise of a meritocracy. Where you end up depends much more now on your education and on your qualifications. But unfortunately, or depending on what your views of social mobility, where you end up in terms of your education and your qualifications depends much more on who your parents were. And I think one of the things people forget about Michael Young's book, where he coined the term the meritocracy, was that it was a satire. It was not a justification of income differentials. It was an attack on the smugness of the meritocrats, and also, or I think, a rather prescient view of their likelihood to produce a self-perpetuating elite, and that we do begin to see the beginnings of. I think what that leads up to is that explanation in terms of factors that have driven the labour market, like skill bias, technological change, and the things that have boosted the earning power of people with high skills and have reduced the earning power, the labour market power of those with low skills, is an explanation of what has happened, but not necessarily a justification of it. Well, that's it for the Onion Spires. Let me move on to the two well-known figures here. The point I want to really make here is quite a simple one, and that is that policy matters, that what governments decide to do makes a profound difference to people's life chances and where they end up, if you like, where they end up, and how narrowly distributed the picture we saw at the beginning is. Just a couple of illustrations of this. All countries have been hit by the kind of technological change and global market changes that I was describing a moment ago that have affected the high-skilled and the low-skilled. But if you look at what's happened to wage differentials in different countries, while there has been an increase in the wage gap here, this is the decile ratio, it's the ratio between the cutoffs for the top 10 and bottom 10% of the earnings distribution. There has been a big increase in the UK, and there was an even bigger increase between the early 80s and the late 90s in the USA. There were also increases in New Zealand, to some extent in Australia, but it was not, and in the Netherlands from a lower base, but it was not a uniform picture. There were other countries that were hit by the same forces, but either because they didn't, for instance, have such a large stock of low-skilled workers to start with, or because they had labour market institutions like minimum wage legislation or powerful unions that resisted that change, they weren't hit in the same way. So these factors were not inexorable when we compare different countries. And when you then go on to look at what's happened to income distribution, there are countries which had an increase in the dispersion of earnings, but that did not lead to an increase in the inequality of people's disposable incomes. Because what government did through the taxation system, through the social security system, in some way offset or slowed down that process. So again here you'll see the hatch lines here are for the mid-1980s, the solid lines are for the mid-1990s. This is data from the Luxembourg Income Study. Up at the top, and Britain is now up at the top, just behind the USA in this comparison, you see both the USA and UK have significant increases. So did other English-speaking countries like Ireland and, rather oddly, Italy, the English-speaking country. But other countries lower down did not. And rather interestingly, Canada, which I didn't have on the previous slide, but Canada had quite a large increase in earnings dispersion, but did not end up with a big increase in income inequality. And that was because of the effect of what governments were doing. So the state has potentially a big effect. And indeed, in the UK, the state has a very large effect. If you compare people's incomes from the market with what they end up with after the effects of receiving social security benefits from the state and receiving benefits from things like health and education and maybe housing subsidies with what they have to pay in, what the system does is to narrow the people's final incomes. So you will see here that social spending, health, education, social security, is generally speaking in absolute terms worth more at the bottom. And that's true actually of things like the state pension, which aren't means tested, but it's obviously true, or mainly true, of things that are means tested, such as income support. And it's true to an extent for health and education. Poorer people tend to need more health care, and people with children tend to be lower down the distribution because they have more mouths to share the income amongst. Whereas taxation does grow with income. Largely speaking, the UK has a proportional tax system that most people pay about 30% of their income in tax one way or another, although that's not true right at the top where it's a little lower. and it's not true right at the bottom, where it's a bit higher. So at the ends, we have a technically regressive tax system measured in this way. But even a slightly regressive tax system combined with a slightly pro-poor spending system leads to significant gains for the bottom half of the distribution and significant losses for the bottom half of the distribution if you allocate only, in this case, the tax that's needed to pay for social spending. I should have said these are figures from the Office for National Statistics. So what the state does is even in the current situation, has a redistributive effect, and changes in it feed into those changes in income distribution that I was showing earlier on. One of the factors that's driven that is, for instance, the relative value of Social Security benefits. This shows here, taken from a Department for Work and Pensions series, the value of four specimen benefits in relation to average earnings over the last 30 years. And the picture you see here, the solid line, for instance, is the basic pension. At the end of the 1970s, the basic pension just poked above a quarter of average earnings. It's now, with price linking, down to 16% of average earnings. Benefits for the unemployed, which at one point were set at the same level. This is either non-means-tested insurance-based job seekers allowance, nowadays very much the same as income support for a single person. Started falling much earlier. It's price-linked. It's now down to about 12% of average earnings. The big recent change is in the value of means-tested support for pensioners, now known as the guarantee credit, previously known as the minimum income guarantee, previously known as income support, before that known as national assistance, which has grown significantly and is now, if you claim it, now £105-ish, £104 a week, for a single pensioner, is now at its highest value since the early 1980s, in fact, almost since the link to earnings was broken in the early 1980s. And this is part of what has happened has driven that widening of the income distribution in the last 25 years. But overall, if you look at the more recent period and look at include in the whole structure of the tax system, what's happened to tax credits, you end up with a very different picture in the UK from what you would see if you looked at the United States. If you looked at what's been happening in the USA in the last few years, we've had a situation where there have been debt-financed tax cuts benefiting almost entirely the top 1% of the distribution. There are occasions in which people link the two governments across the Atlantic, but the distributional effects of their tax and benefit changes should not be one of them. This is modelling by Holly Sutherland, now at Essex University, of what's the difference in the income people get under the current tax and benefit system, the 2004-05 system, with the position they would have been put in if we'd started from 1997 before the election and just rolled the system forward, indexing benefits with prices, and indexing tax allowances with price, and leaving everything unchanged with no reform. And you'll see from that that not everybody's a gainer, but on average, the bottom 20% of the distribution are substantial gainers. The grey bars here are for the population as a whole. The shaded bars are for children, or for families including children, with gains of over a quarter in income for the poorest tenth, as a result of not just the tax credit changes for people in work that people are familiar with, but also with the changes that were made to income support allowances for families with children, which have now been consolidated into the child tax credit. These are very big increases. And one of the interesting comparisons is to say, well, suppose we weren't comparing with what would actually be a rather mean system, which was to take the 1997 system and only uprate everything with prices, but to follow, if you like, a kind of old Labour policy of not reforming the system, but increasing the value of everything in line with earnings, and instead compare today's actual system, post-reform system, with what it would have looked like under that, quote, old Labour system. The gains you see by comparison with that base are smaller, but they're still significant. Children in the poorest tenth, 15% better off, their families 15% better off than they would have been under that alternative. The other thing you see is it's much more clearly
redistributive when you compare it with an old Labour alternative, that people towards the top would have done better under an unreformed earnings-linked system than they do under the actual system we have today. So, and in fact, these numbers almost balance each other out. Now, these kind of changes matter. They matter to people's lives. And we're beginning to see some of the effects of that. I'm not sure whether Alan Marsh from Policy Studies Institute made it to this evening's lecture, but these are figures drawn from the work he and colleagues have been doing on the Families and Children's Study, which has been running since 1999. It had predecessor studies. And the best comparison we can make is for lone parents. These show just a few examples of deprivation and financial stress for lone parents back in 1999 when this series starts. So at that point, nearly a tenth of lone parents reported that they couldn't afford a weatherproof coat for each child. Three-quarters of them said they couldn't afford a week's holiday. It says a week's holiday away, not with relatives, is the actual question. I'm not sure whether that means... It's ruling out any holiday with relatives or just ones where you're not staying in your grandparents' home. But 48% of lone parents back in 1999 said that they never had money left over at the end of the week or the end of the month. By 2002, which is the date at which the child tax credit reforms had come in and income support allowances had gone up, all of those numbers are significantly down. And some of them by really considerable amounts. Obviously, it's a problem that 30% of lone parents say that they are worried about money almost all the time, but that is a lot less than the 45% back in 1999. And the fall in the number who never have money left over from 48% to 17% seems to me to be quite stunning. So these changes, which are kind of abstract modelling of people's lives, people's incomes, you can see the effects they're having on people's lives. So what government does matters. Back to Ian Dury, the album some of you will have recognised, I wouldn't have done, I have to say, is Reasons to be Cheerful. And what I want to run through quickly for a moment are reasons largely taken from the long-running British Social Attitudes Survey, a lot of material from which you can find in the book, if you're intrigued by this, that suggests that if your own views on these distributional issues are what I would describe as progressive, then you are not alone, that the majority of the population in many cases is with you. And there are many different ways I could show you this, but the overall message from this is that inequality is unpopular. What I've put up here is going back to the Gini coefficient I put up before, produced on the HBAI basis by the Institute for Fiscal Studies, which you'll see kind of goes up and is still on this basis a bit higher than it was back in 1996. Taking account of the whole income distribution here, but you see the growth in income in income inequality over the 1980s. And the line up here, using the right-hand scale, is the proportion of the population who say that the gap in income between rich and poor is too large. And that grew steadily through the 1980s. It peaked at about 84% in 1996, but it's remained above 80% all the way through. Four-fifths of the population say that the gap in income between rich and poor is too large. And not just that, but three-quarters of the population, when asked about it, say that it's the government's responsibility to do something about it. This isn't, in the UK case, this is not seen as something that's just an act of God and is inexorable. This is something that people believe governments should be doing something about. The UK is towards the egalitarian end of this. This is information from the the ISSP survey from the late 1990s. Sharon will get at me afterwards with the correct name. This is very much the same question. The percentage agreeing that the gap between rich and poor is too large, and this is Great Britain on this series, just under 80%. Substantially higher than the US, but note that even in the US, 60% of the population believe that the gap between rich and poor is too large. People thinking of their own country, and then in some countries such as Portugal, it's even nearer to 100%. But this is a majoritarian position. Most people believe in this. And this kind of belief in greater inequality is reflected by in what happens when you ask people, and this slide said 1992 at one point, and it was corrected to say 2002, but for some reason it's still saying 1992. These are answers in the year 2002. Asks people, what do the following people earn in 2002, not 1992, and then what should they earn? So people's guess of what people's earnings, 2 years ago now, was that a shop assistant earned £9,000 a year and the chairman of a large corporation earned £125,000 a year. Now, I've always wanted to ask, is there a doctor in the house? I mean, there are lots of people with doctorates, but a proper medical doctor. Well, I've got good news for you, Doc, that you're the one group of higher paid people that people in general think should be paid more. When you ask people what they should earn, doctors, they were thinking earned £35,000 a year, but ought to get 40, as opposed to solicitors who, instead of getting 50, ought to get 40. And appeal court judges, they thought getting 80, but ought to get 50, whereas the lower paid people, they all thought should be paid a bit more. There's this push towards a more equal distribution of earnings. But what's stunning about these figures is how far the higher figures, with the exception of you poor, unfortunate solicitors out there, if you're doing law, you're doing the wrong degree, according to these figures, what people are actually earning. And GPs were actually on 51,000 a year back in 2002. Cabinet ministers were on 94,000, not on 60,000, but people thought they should be on half that. They could actually have drawn, I think, 105,000 at that point. And appeal court judges were actually on 140,000, and now rather more than that. And as for chairmen of large corporations that the public think are overpaid at 125,000, the average for the FTSE top 100 chairmen, chief executives, and so on, was £555,000 a year, and that's before you start including the bonuses and the share options. So despite the fact that people have no idea how high the top of the onion spire is, they still think it ought to be narrower than it really is. Meanwhile, a lot of official statistics, perhaps controversially, are based on the kind of concept I was putting up earlier on of relative poverty measures, counting whether people are poor depending on their income in relation to typical incomes. The views you get from the British Social Attitudes Survey are consistent with that kind of view. When you ask people in Britain today, is there quite a lot of real poverty or really very little real poverty, nearly two-thirds go for the quite a lot option. When you ask people what's been happening to it, up to quite recently, the large majority said that poverty had been increasing, which would only be true if you took a rather relative view of poverty, if you used a standard that rose over time as people's living standards rose. The most recent figures I've got here for 2000, there's a kind of balance between whether poverty is increasing or whether it's staying the same. There's certainly very few people saying that poverty is decreasing. But if you took an absolutist view of poverty, if you measure poverty in the way that the US poverty line is set, for instance, as an amount which is adjusted only for inflation each year, throughout this whole period, you would be saying that poverty was decreasing. That's clearly not a way of looking at what's happening to poverty that's shared by people. And most people don't blame the poor for it. Less than a quarter blame the laziness or lack of application of the poor for their position, although that is more than was the case in the 1980s, and somewhat fewer blame injustice in our society. The majority either think it's bad luck, some of them think it's inevitable, and a significant number think that it's injustice. Those views are towards the harsher end of the European scale. Within Europe, using Eurobarometer statistics, only people in Portugal are more likely to blame laziness or lack of application on the part of the poor. The EU average is only 18% at that end, as opposed to 31% blaming injustice. And notably, 42% of Swedes blame injustice in their society for poverty, which just shows how high some people's standards are. And I should say that we haven't got an exact comparison for the US, but when offered a straight choice between the two ends of this, between laziness and lack of application that wanted versus injustice, 62% of US respondents to the World Value Survey blamed laziness or lack of application, and only about a third blamed injustice in our society. So there's a very big, another example of that big divide. People also believe in a progressive tax system. They believe that the share of income paid by those with high income should be greater than the share paid by people with low incomes. I mean, not much larger. 11% say much larger, 55% say larger, 29% the same. Only 1% say that people on high incomes should pay a lower proportion of their income in tax than people with lower incomes. In terms of whether they think it is, they think that it's kind of a bit like that, actually. They think that the tax system is technically progressive, that people on higher incomes do pay a higher proportion of their income in tax than people with lower incomes. The correct answer is, in fact, that it's smaller, that if you look at the share of income paid by the top 10th, it is a smaller fraction of income than people lower down. People also think that the government, but they're getting more equivocal about this, think that government should redistribute from the people with high incomes to people who are less well off. There's still 39% of people are still agreeing with that kind of proposition, more than people who disagree. But back in the 1980s, there was much more substantial agreement for the resonance of the word redistribution than there used to be. But what happens is if you start tunneling underneath this, you find that it's not so much redistribution per se that people are after. It's about different views of how society should be organized. And there are very strong views in favor of a system of social spending which is effectively universal. There's a lot of skepticism about means testing, a belief that that services should be available for all, which has that kind of pro-poor effect that I put up earlier, and that the tax system should be, if not proportional, it should be progressive. And of course, the effect of those two together is, as I showed, to redistribute between rich and poor. Now, in some qualitative work carried out for us last year, which we're now trying to survey nationally, Alan Hedges asked some focus groups what they thought about that, and he kind of worked through, and people agreed that that was exactly what they wanted, and he then sort of put it, well, you know, okay, so what you're arguing, and I think he was talking to a rather conservative elderly group at the time, so what you're arguing is that it's basically to each according to their needs and from each according to their ability to pay. And one of his respondents, a middle-aged lady, turned around and said, yes, it sounds very communist, doesn't it? Am I being a communist? But I think those are actually mainstream values, that the system, it may not be there that people see the state as a giant Robin Hood to achieve what they're saying, but they support these systems that achieve that. Okay, let me move on. Oh, all right, I should say that there are some constraints on this. I'll go over this rather quickly. If you ask people in detail about their views of the social security system, you find that the items that actually make up the bulk of the social security system, pensions, spending on children, spending on disabled people, and so on, are popular, and people should think there should be more spending on them, even if that meant higher taxes. However, they don't put the social security system high up their list of priorities for greater spending. And one of the reasons for that is that when you ask them where is the money spent, 3/4 of the population nearly think that benefits for the unemployed are the either largest or second largest item in the Social Security budget. The truth is that 5% of the Social Security budget is spent on benefits for the unemployed. And those are benefits that people are rather sceptical about. They're sceptical about on grounds of fraud and on grounds of potential disincentives and worries that people are cheating the system. The other items, which they think are not the bulk of the system, are very popular ones. So we have a kind of political market failure here. So although there are reasons to be cheerful in terms of people's overall attitudes towards distribution, I think one has to be careful in terms of exactly what instruments one's using, or alternatively in terms of the way one explains what is actually going on here and how the system really works. Okay, let me end up now with the Gothic horror. This is Edgar Allan Poe. Some of you will know this story. It's a short story. It's called The Pit and the Pendulum. And it's set in the time of the Spanish Inquisition, and it features a man you can see here tied in place in a horrible dungeon. And the first thing that happens to him is that through the darkness he realizes that this sharp-bladed pendulum is gradually descending on him. With each swing, it comes nearer and nearer, to him, threatening, of course, to slice him in half. Now, he does, in a way I will explain in a moment, manage to escape from this, but no sooner has he escaped from this than he realizes that the walls of his cell are slowly closing in on him, and these walls are now red hot, and they're threatening to push him into a terrible pit down beneath. Now, it seems to me that life inside the treasury is probably a bit like that. In fact, it's probably rather like that for policymakers all the way across Europe, that what people see are inexorable upward pressures on social spending as a result of aging, as a result of aspirations. So those demands are pushing in the whole time, and yet the constraint of what can be raised in taxation is getting ever nearer. Now, you wouldn't have guessed this, actually, from the forecast that the Treasury published of long-term forecasts for public spending a couple of years ago. Now, I have to be fair to the Treasury here. These forecasts were based on demographic predictions, last but two, actually, which the Government Actuaries Department made, made earlier, and since then they've added a year and a half to my expected life expectancy, which I'm very grateful for, and almost certainly to yours as well. So, in fact, the most recent figures do show a bit more growth than that, and I should also say these came out before the Pensions Commission report had landed on their desks. But what their projection showed was that, looking at these big items and looking at government spending as a whole, the picture actually isn't too worrying, even allowing for the ageing of the population that was forecast at that point. Yes, health spending rising from 6.3 to 9.8% of national income, education spending rising a bit, pensions staying very much the same share. Now, the most recent forecasts are based on current government assumptions about future indexation are that that would actually be rising by 0.8% of GDP rather than falling by a little. But, you know, the other items elsewhere in the budget are falling, and the total is only rising from 38.6% of GDP to 40.8% of GDP over a 50-year period. I mean, this really is not a big problem. Now, it seems to me that is a rather surprising conclusion, knowing what we know about aging. A rather more simple-minded calculation is to say, well, suppose we had today a population with the age structure that is now forecast, on actually now the last but one GA forecast, for 2051, and we spent the same amount in relation to today's incomes for people of a given age. So if we're spending so much on healthcare for somebody aged 60 now, we assume we'll spend the same amount in relation to GDP on people aged 60 in 2051. And I wonder why education has been disappeared off that. You'll have to look at the book to discover what the figure for education is. Or you can do some quick mathematics and you can subtract the other three figures from 26.3. What you'd actually see is education falling slightly because there will be fewer children. Social Security for those under 65 staying about the same. And Social Security, including pensions for the elderly, if it was income linked and just responded to demographic change, rising from 5.5 to 9.1% of GDP. An increase not just of 1.8%, which we saw before, but an increase of 4.5% of GDP. So aging by itself, not allowing for anything else, if we kept the rules of the game going in relation to contemporary income, would mean social spending rising by 4.5% of GDP. Now, there are two ways of reacting to that. The first is to say that this is a very frightening figure. This is the blade or the walls closing in on you very, very fast. 4.5% of GDP is £50 billion. To raise it would mean putting up every single tax rate by an eighth. It would be extremely uncomfortable to do it. It would be even worse if you put it all on income tax in terms of pain. The other way of looking at it is to say, well, this actually isn't too bad at all. I mean, we're talking about a 50-year period here. We're talking about a growth rate over that period, 21.8 to 26.3, of 0.4% per year. The current plans by 2008 will have put 3% of GDP on health and education spending alone over a nine-year period. This is only a bit more than that. A lot of the health spending there is already factored in to government spending plans and government tax plans up to 2008. It's that kind of increase is half the increase we had
over a 20-year period between the 1950s and the 1970s. It's clearly a feasible increase if we wanted to do it. So in one way it's frightening, another way it's something we could cope with. But I have to say that those of you who are here at a lecture which Howard Glenister gave earlier in the year, most of the risks are on the upside. The variant I've put up there for health spending is actually assuming that what we do is we implement the lower number, 10.8%, is that we implement government plans for health spending per capita up to 2008 and then go with demographic change. The higher number assumes that we take the whole of the Derek Wanless report recommendations up to 2020 and then move with income growth and demographic change. And that would take health spending up to double what it is, what it's been. The other number I've put there is to explain a little of where the Treasury has got its kind of slightly reassuring numbers from. The 1.9% of GDP on Social Security for the under-65s, is what you get if you only price-link Social Security for the next 50 years. And that is what creates the room within the Treasury's rather reassuring long-term forecast. It's the assumption that we can carry on linking the value of benefits apart from the elderly to the value of prices. Now, that, if you pull that through and you actually did that, that would be the equivalent of asking an unemployed couple to live after their housing costs on an income of £32 a week in today's Britain. I just do not believe that asking people to live on those kind of income levels in 50 years' time, the equivalent today of £86 a week in real terms, would be acceptable. If it happened, it would imply deeper poverty for those who remained dependent on benefits. And it seems to me that that point illustrates a central dilemma for policy over the next 50 years. This tension between the upward pressure on social spending and the distributional consequences of some of the potential solutions. Now, in the book, in the conclusion, I identify five different ways in which you can try and deal with this. I'll rattle through these rather quickly, all of which are being followed in one way at the moment. One strategy is to try and limit social spending in relation to incomes, and that's exactly what we're doing for working-age Social Security. We're linking their values, apart from people with children, to prices rather than earnings. That becomes easier to finance cost falls in relation to national income. But the trouble is, unless something else changes, unless you manage to get very large numbers of people off benefit, it means deepening and possibly widening poverty. And if you applied it to things like health and education, because you've got the pressure of trying to keep doctors and nurses and teachers' salaries up, it would mean less volume of resources for each unit of demand, and quality would undoubtedly fall behind people's expectations. A second strategy is to maintain social spending but concentrate it more on the poor. In other words, to take head-on, try to keep down the overall rise in spending, but within that to protect people at the bottom. That's effectively what's happening with higher education policy at the moment and with the current strategy towards future pensions. And it succeeds in concentrating limited resources on those most in need, and we've seen the effects of that through the figures for child poverty. But it does imply some form or other of means testing somewhere in the system. And the evidence looked at in the book suggests, first of all, this is rather unpopular with a lot of people. Secondly, that there are often take-up problems. And thirdly, I suggest, and I won't go into detail, that we've probably reached the limit of the overlapping means tests that we can apply. It also, and I think this is the huge political problem, it means a loss, if you're within an effectively constant budget, a loss at the middle, in the middle. Or you can try and go further than that, which is to not have losses in the middle, but to have gains at the bottom. This is what the government describes as progressive universalism, that you succeed in bringing poverty down. It still, however, involves some form of means test, and it also implies, in the end, some kind of increase in taxation, at least the share of tax devoted to social spending, but possibly with nothing visible in the middle. And there's a problem there, so you might try and get ahead of that, try and keep spending up. This is effectively what's been happening with school spending recently. But again, this implies rising costs as a share of GDP, higher taxes, which may only be acceptable for some services, and again, could be perceived as higher taxes with nothing to show. Or you can try and go beyond that, which is effectively what the government is doing for the health services, to get ahead of the game, increase spending beyond the increase needed to keep doctors' and nurses' salaries up with earnings elsewhere in the economy, beyond what you need to cope with demographic change, even if we don't get kind of an increase in healthy aging. That should deliver an increase in the quality and quantity of service, but it means
taxes at the higher end. And the question is, can those higher taxes be sold? And particularly, can they be sold for things necessary not just to have a standstill on poverty, but to actually reduce it for others than those just with children or pensioners? Now, as I think you will have noticed, none of these is all upside. And my argument is that actually one of the central challenges to policy at the moment is how to explain to people that those are the choices. Now, of course, maybe there's a magic way out. And those of you who've read the Edgar Allan Poe story will remember that what happens is he has got his hands, he's got some bacon rinds, and he manages to smear his bonds with these bacon rinds, and some helpful rats come along and gnaw away his bonds. And that's how he manages to roll clear of this descending pendulum. And then the walls close in on him, and they are just about to push him into the pit when luckily the French army arrives, raises the siege of Toledo, and turns all the machinery off. So I suppose my final question is, well, is there a way out of these dilemmas? What are our candidates? Well, I think I'm going to concentrate on the rats. I think it's unlikely the French army are going to help on this one either. These are my seven candidates. I talk about them a significant amount in the book, and I'll go over them extremely quickly. What about growth? Well, my argument is that growth helps you a lot less than you might think. Growth helps you. People get paid more, but the doctors want to be paid more. The street sweepers want to be paid more. If you don't pay them more, quality goes down. Okay, they're being paid more, but that's because they're more productive. So they ought to be able to do more with less. And indeed, that's what's happened to universities. Hooray. But there's a problem with that, which is that as the rest of the economy improves and productivity elsewhere increases, people want more. Their expectations for the quality of services go up. So everything we get out of productivity is almost certainly needed to stand still. And it's worse than that, because we know that things like health and education are, in economic terms, luxury goods, that as we get richer, we want more of them. And richer societies spend a bigger fraction of their income on health and education. So in fact, it could be much worse than the kind of figures I've been putting up. What about cuts elsewhere? Well, yes. I mean, one of the remarkable things about the last, not just 6 years, but the last 10 years, is the extent to which increases in social spending have been accommodated not by tax increases necessarily, but by cuts in other parts of the budget, particularly by cuts in defence spending as a share of national income and by falls in debt interest. It seems to me that we're beginning to get to the end of that particular road. Social spending is now two-thirds of all government spending. There's not enough, a lot else out there to squeeze. I mean, maybe people think there's more room to squeeze defence spending. Maybe people think there's more room to squeeze transport infrastructure investment, but it's getting tougher and tougher. There is, of course, ever-popular waste, always popular with all parties. It seems to me that the point here is that of course, it is always true to find examples of waste. It is always possible to find, for instance, loss-making log cabins belonging to the Forestry Commission. And it's equivalent. I remember once talking to the then head of the Audit Commission about, you know, do you run out of things to do? And he said, no, we just turn over stones. Every time we turn over stones, we do find something there that could be done more efficiently. And then we go back to the beginning again, and we find more of it. But that's the point. It is always possible to turn over stones and find efficiency savings, but that's what creates the productivity growth which you need to meet the expectations. Maybe more hopeful, what about reducing market inequalities? If we had, fewer low-skilled people, then the government wouldn't be having to do so much to compensate for it. On the other hand, creating low-skilled people costs you money in the education budget. Maybe we can cut some of these demands. For instance, through later retirement, but that's an entirely different lecture. Last but one rat, maybe we can solve this. Rather than uncomfortable taxes on people like us, we can tax bad things, we can use environmental taxes. But we are living in the middle of a hugely successful experiment in taxing bads, the London congestion charge, which has made my cycling vastly better. But it doesn't raise much money, and it doesn't raise much money because it's changed people's behaviour. Fewer people are driving into the centre of London, so it doesn't make a huge profit. And that's great because it's improved the quality of life. Alternatively, maybe you tax bad things and people carry on doing them, but then they're going to start worrying that that tax will hit them. That's exactly what we saw through the fuel tax protests a few years ago. So it may be a good thing to do, but it's still not comfortable. And then finally,
I did a little bit of work for the Institute for the International Monetary Fund once, and they told me a wonderful international tax experts rhyme, which goes, let's not tax me, let's not tax you, let's tax the man behind the tree. And the easy way out of all of this is to say, well, there is some other person who could pay the bill. I think that's rather unlikely. The central theme of the book is that the ways in which the two sides of the government budget, spending and taxation, affect distribution, are generally speaking rather poorly understood. And the discussions of the crucial trade-offs involved in policy change are often taken by default. However, the way income distribution develops is not something that's a product of inexorable forces. It is something that we can do things about. We do have choices, but in making those choices, we need to have our eyes open to the sometimes uncomfortable trade-offs and choices that they involve. Thank you.
If you have to go, go now. Otherwise, we will start questions, which will run for about 20 minutes. We usually take questions in clusters of five to give the audience more chance to raise issues. So, the floor is yours. Please.
Hello. My name is James Sproul. I'm an economist in the city. One of the statistics you didn't point out, which I think is also worthy of note, the top 1% of earners pay 26% of all income tax. The top 10% of earners pay 53% of all income tax. So it is still pretty progressive, so long as you don't realize or so long as you don't feel that the objective is to have equality of outcome at the end of the tax system. But you advance the idea that people are very, very keen to pay more taxes, and I just wonder, why did Gordon Brown feel it necessary to introduce stealth taxes to achieve this? Surely if it was as popular as you suggest, he could have avoided the rather economically distorting taxes he's introduced and simply smacked up smacked up income tax.
Clear question. Yes. At the top. Well, whilst the audience is working, do you want to address that?
Well, let me address both of those. I think one of the things that's important to realize is that income tax raises, it's in the book, 26 to 30% of all government revenue. It is the one part of the whole tax system that is progressive. It's the one item where people on high incomes do pay more than people on lower incomes. But if you look at the totality of the tax system...
Well, let him finish, and then you could...
Look at the totality of the tax system, you see that most across nearly all the income range, from the second tenth from the bottom to the second tenth from the top, people pay very much the same share of income in tax. So, yes, the share of income tax is rising, and the share but the share of other taxes, value-added tax, drinks on taxes on drinks and tobacco, council tax, is falling. And those things offset each other. In fact, people in the top tenth pay a smaller fraction of their gross income in tax than people on the lowest income. So income tax, it's true, it is progressive, but it is the only substantial inheritance tax, if you can work out who pays it, might be another example, and some forms of stamp duty might be another. So yes, it is also true that the top 10% pay a very large fraction of income tax, but that's because they have a very, very large fraction of income. And what we're exploring this in more depth, and we'll have some results from this next year when we've got results back from the 2004 British Social Attitude Survey. We are trying to get at this. Do people really mean progressive when they say it? When they say the share should be higher, do they really mean that the share should be higher, which is what I've been talking about, or have they got some other notion that it's actually they really mean? When they say share, they really mean the amount paid. And, of course, even in an aggressive tax system, people with high incomes might pay a bigger fraction of income. But the evidence we've got at the moment is they do mean a progressive tax system, and they're rather shocked. I mean, from the focus group work that was done last year, they were really rather shocked when they discovered that we don't have a progressive tax system overall in that sense. Why stealth taxes? Well, I mean, I did try to hint at some of this, and you'll find in the book there's a lot more detail on this. Yes, of course, people faced with may give
glib answers when asked, you know, would you like to pay higher taxes for health and education, for instance, and would you pay a penny extra on tax? They sometimes may think you mean a penny extra on tax. But the work that's been done on this has tried to nail them down a lot on that and say, do you really mean it? You know, you would have to pay X hundred pounds more. Do you still mean it? And it's quite, when you do that, it turns out that they're still prepared to say, yeah, I mean that as long as it's for health and as long as it's for education. But it's also true that they do often mean somebody who isn't them. They also think, well, you know, the rich ought to pay more tax. And an astonishing proportion of us think that we have middle incomes. So I guess there are some problems with that, but I think you can't leap from some of these figures that say, yes, people are gleefully saying let's pay higher tax. They don't necessarily trust the politicians to deliver what they'd like. They may be answering about an ideal world. And yes, some of what the government has done might be described as stealth taxes, although I think one of the really interesting examples of this is what happened with increased spending on the National Health Service, where there was an increase in both national insurance contributions and in employer national insurance contributions, 1% on each side, the money for which has gone straight into the National Health Service. Now, that was a very upfront move. It's one of the biggest tax changes that's happened, and it was sold, for a particular purpose. One of the conclusions I was coming to there was it might be harder to sell those kind of things for other aims, and it's particularly hard to sell those things if people don't have a better understanding of the way the system works.
Do you want to come back on that quickly? No.
George Day is my name. I just want to ask about, in fact, there's growing inequality, in fact, in tax reliefs, particularly on impact on pension contributions, and also, of course, the ceiling on national insurance contributions, how it benefits, of course, the middle income bracket of earners, and how we can overcome, of course, and my concern is, of course, as a pensioner, in fact, improving the basic state pension. And in fact, and these are obviously opportunities, in fact, of methods, of course, to eliminate or at least drastically reduce means testing, which is clearly a failed system, but even it was built in to the original, in fact, pension credit scheme. The number of people who will not, in fact, claim their entitlement. I mean, for anybody to introduce a scheme on the assumption that 1.4 million pensioners will not claim the benefit seems absolutely ludicrous to me. Thank you.
Pass the mic the other way.
John, there are at least four of us here from the Wicked Treasury, and I thought at one stage in the middle that you were being quite nice to us, but reverted to type by the end. Anyhow, what I wanted to ask you was, do you think there are any countries that have got it right looking out 50 years? And in particular, have those countries which have a better demographic profile got an easier ride over the next 30 to 40 years?
Anyone else down here? Yes. Oh, yes. Two at the front, and then we'll come to you.
Will Paxton from IPPR. I'm searching for rats and French armies as well, and I just wanted to push you a little bit on the option of trying to reduce original income inequality, and you talked about the impact that increasing the soccer skills may have. Do we know for sure that that would have that impact, that would narrow original income, so wage inequalities? And then secondly, you didn't mention the minimum wage, and I just wondered if you had any thoughts about how significant that has been, or whether that's a tool that may be more useful in the future, because it may put some of the emphasis onto employers.
Could you use one more?
Margaret Thomas, graduate of the school. I'm very interested in democratic participation in looking at spending, and was recently involved at Hammersmith and Fulham. I belong to a thing, now I'm retired, Better Government for Older People. It's a Treasury initiative, by the way. So one of the things that we were asked to do by our local council, they were warning that it was quite likely that expenditure would have to go down next year. The council expenditure would have to go down. And would we, as a group of responsible pensioners attending Better Government for Older People, help the council in working out in which areas could council spending be reduced? We found this an incredibly difficult exercise, and we really didn't get very far. One of the greatest problems was that we were presented with global figures, very large figures, and people found it very difficult to assess outcomes from the figures. Then we had the problem between statutory expenditure, which the council had to take, and discretionary expenditure. One thing we did find out, which I'd never known before, that our Freedom Pass cost £187 a year each. Well, we all sat, everybody fell back in astonishment and thought that was the most wonderful value for money that could be thought of. So what I was going to say about this, I'm very pleased the Treasury is putting out the leaflets which now abound in the public libraries in Fulham and Hammersmith, and in my doctor's surgery, for example, these leaflets are being put out. But I really feel a huge effort is needed to try to get people to understand the whole position better.
Thank you. Do you feel like...
Yeah, can I take those for the moment? Okay. Tax reliefs. The numbers I was quoting earlier about the share of income paid in tax is after allowing for the effects of tax reliefs. And, of course, one of the reasons why people on higher incomes pay less of their income tax than they otherwise would are the effects of tax reliefs, although I think you might like to note that some of those have been significantly reduced in the last 10 years, for instance, tax relief for mortgage interest and so on, which used to be available at your highest marginal tax rate and so on. And you might also have noticed that the total value of tax relief for pension contributions and the way the Inner Revenue calculated it was magically cut by £3 billion a couple of weeks ago. But that was unfortunately because we'd realized that the pension contributions were a lot lower than we thought they were, so that wasn't quite such good news. You're right, of course, that one of the things that contributes to the overall system are things like the ceiling on national insurance contributions, the upper earnings limit, although you might like to note that there is no ceiling on employer national insurance contributions. That then, however, plays into your first tax relief point, because, for instance, if your employer contributes to a pension for you, the employer gets relief on national insurance contributions. And that's one of the reasons why it's not true to argue that for most people, putting money into a pension isn't a good deal. It's actually a very good deal for most people. It's a good deal for people on high incomes, and it's actually and a surprisingly good deal for some people on low incomes. If you're receiving tax credits, it's a very good deal to put money into a pension rather than take it out in net pay. Now, the outcomes, as you may know, the Pensions Commission is currently in its consultation phase, and I will take away your views on the basic state pension and the effects of means testing with a lot of gratitude. And we'll... be looking at that in our report in a year's time. Sue Owen was asking for, first of all, countries that have done better. Well, the trouble is always the usual suspects that have done better, and they often turn out to be smaller countries, Sweden, Netherlands, Denmark. But there are countries that have faced similar problems and have and things have turned out in a different way from here, even without some of the knock-on effects in the labour market that, for instance... rigid labour markets, a bad thing, might have created. You ask whether there are countries that are going to have an easier demographic ride. Not a lot, frankly. I mean, one of the remarkable things about the scale of the British pensions problem is that we have one of the least bad demographic shifts in the whole of Europe. I mean, there are about three countries that have a less bad shift than us. You know, we already have quite a few older people, and our fertility rate is at least, you know, it is 1.7. And if you look at the change in a country like Korea, for instance, you know, we will have to cope with much less than that. So there are, I think, three countries, somewhere in there, I list about three countries which are going to have a slightly easier ride than us. But basically the problem is one that all the rest of Europe faces as well. And that's another reason why looking to the French army for solutions isn't necessarily very plausible. Thinking that you can solve this problem by investing abroad is not particularly... I mean, we can do some of it, but they will be facing the same problems as us. Yes, I'm sorry I didn't have time to say more about affecting original income. I mean, both on the skills front, clearly it seems to me that one of the reasons why earnings distribution in Germany did not increase as badly as it did in Britain in response to the technological shock is that they had fewer low-skilled workers than we had. So you can make a difference to that, but it'll cost you. The minimum wage I kind of mentioned in passing at one point. At the moment, the minimum wage in Britain is not that high. There's no evidence at all that introducing it has had a detrimental effect on employment. And we could perhaps be a bit braver on the minimum wage. And there's some rather interesting evidence by a man called Darren Acemoglu, probably mispronounced,
that suggests that one of the reasons why skill-biased technological changes had less of an effect on the continent is precisely the effect of minimum wages, that it pressurizes workers and employers into making more investment in the skills in their... If you're having to pay higher wages, then as long as it's within reason, then there's more reason for investing in people's skills to make sure that they don't have low productivity. So, yes, there are some rats out there. I mean, I'd be a bit more optimistic about those rats than about productivity and so on. And then finally, about democratic participation, I just couldn't agree more, and I wish there were more experiments of that kind. I mean, most of these numbers people really do know nothing about, and the scale of these numbers and the sort of choices involved and how much of the budget goes on things that it's rather hard to start thinking about cutting, I think are not known to people. The shape of the income distribution is not known to people. I said before, most people think they have a middle income. Their boss is paid more and they know somebody who's paid less. Therefore, they're in the middle and it's the people up there that should be paying it. The more people can understand that, I think it's a very, very difficult exercise, which I'm sure has to be built up in part right from the bottom, numbers people can grapple with. I'm sure for most people, maybe all of us, numbers in billions, I mean, you know, what on earth does that mean? It's only when you can start bringing this down to so much per head, and I think understanding that the Freedom Pass costs £170 per week, and I'm not going to get it for several years. It's not fair. But it's understanding that kind of number, I think, would hugely contribute to and would begin to make the life of people in the Treasury a lot easier. Because at the moment, there is a huge assumption that there is somebody behind the tree and there's all this waste out there that if you got rid of the dome or whatever it is, everything would pay for itself. And I think it just ain't like that.
We unfortunately have to go in just a few moments. Maybe a couple more questions of one sentence. Potentially questions that could be answered with a yes or no would be appreciated. A sentence or two.
I can't find a French army, but I'm more worried about fifth columns at the moment, which is the ability of the wealthy and corporations to select their own tax regime. Obviously, most of it has to be done by Rupert Murdoch, but not by him alone. And you've described a closed system without international leakages. I wonder whether you could comment on that.
That's a good, great question. Yes, you've been waiting over there. Anyone upstairs? I don't want to... No? Okay, one last question.
In the long run, it is surely much less expensive to teach people to fish rather than to give them a new fish every year. So wouldn't it make sense, even at the cost of cutting other social spending, to focus as much as possible on closing the skill gap? I mean, the UK has 20% functional literacy. That's more than three times more than Sweden. And there's a very, very strong correlation between functional illiteracy and poverty.
Perhaps
so
I could
cutting
ask.
Other social spending, yeah. Focus all the efforts on that.
Perhaps I could ask also one question. It may not be an arm at the cavalry that we can look forward to, but your analysis doesn't really integrate wealth as a separate issue. And I notice that wealth is not a category in your index.
Should be.
It isn't. So I mean, that may not be that may be symbolic significance. When you build systematic analysis of wealth into this and the unequal distribution of wealth, inheritance and so on, is there not an open avenue there? It's not in the index, but I'm glad there's a category in one of the chapters. Is there not an avenue there around which additional resources may or may not be found? It's a complex issue, especially given the issue of international leakage and so on, but it's an issue.
Okay, let me try and quickly take those three points. Yes, of course, we are now talking about a country with open capital markets, without exchange controls. Life is very different from the world of Mrs. Thatcher's first government, when she had tax rates of 75% on nominal investment income, for instance, or you know, the whole period of 40 years after the Second World War, when top tax rates were above 90%. It would be very hard to get away with that these days for a lot of categories of income. Clearly, the moment you start taxing mobile factors, they will disappear off to other countries. But can I note three things on that? First of all, some of the places they would disappear off to are British dependency tax havens, which we could begin to think about, perhaps, whether that is really in the national interest. Secondly, a lot of these rates, there is some scope before you get anywhere near the industrialized country average of higher tax rates. I'm not saying that that's necessarily the way you would want to go politically, but I don't think there's a binding constraint on either income taxes or corporation taxes. I rather think it's a political decision, and it's a very important and difficult political decision, because if you start saying you're going to start taxing rich people more, people think, well, if they're coming for the rich people today, they're coming for me tomorrow, and they're not very happy about that. But you know, we are not at the top of the international tax range. There is a bit of a scope there, but less than it was. Yes, of course, I think a lot of people are in the business of teaching people to fish rather than just handing out fish. And if you look at the returns to investments in the New Deal, for instance, for getting people into work, those are, you know, the effects of those are not massive in terms of number of people, but they are positive and they're clearly worth doing. And clearly the same is true of education. But you may want to be doing both at the same time. So, for instance, the assault on child poverty may be simultaneously, if you like, a protective policy for the current generation, for parents today and for children as they grow up, but it may also be a preventive policy for the future, that may make people's lives easier as they grow up, and that may help people stay in school longer and end up in better shape, able to fish in the future. So I think probably in a lot of these things one has to do both. And remember, again, this is a political problem. You're trying to satisfy several different demands at the same time. And then finally, I'm greatly upset that wealth didn't make it to the index. But
it is in one of the chapters.
It's in, not in my index, but it's in somebody else's. One of the remarkable things, I did work a few years ago at something called the Joseph Rowntree Foundation Inquiry into Income and Wealth, and it didn't have a lot on wealth because wealth was dead boring. Nothing had happened to the distribution of wealth for 20 years. It stayed exactly the same. Almost the moment we published the report, the distribution of wealth started moving apart, and we're now back to the position of at least the early 1970s and heading back towards the 1960s in terms of distribution of wealth. It has become a lot more unequal. If you like, that increase in income inequality has become congealed now. People have been able to save, and that's turned into wealth inequality. And there's a lot of money there. You know, I mean, there are billions, there are trillions of pounds out there if you could get hold of it. But it is unbelievably hard to get hold of it. If there isn't a flow of income that you can grab at a source, going along to people and saying, you have wealth, we would like to charge you, well, you know how the council tax works. It's very, very hard to get money off people like that. And of course, you know, you could say, well, let's take it to the point of inheritance. And one of the remarkable things is that if you have discussions with, I'm sure, many of the people in the audience, inheritance is an obvious target. You know, it's income that has come to people through no desert, but the accident of birth and luck of their parents happening to, for instance, own a house in London rather than in Redcar. But actually, it is devastatingly unpopular to start suggesting higher inheritance taxes. It's in practice, it is quite hard to see the ways in which we really can raise more money out of wealth. Yes, there is some scope there, but having gone through and looked at the fate, for instance, of the wealth tax that was proposed in the 1970s, looked at the concessions that have been made for capital transfer tax, used to be made for estate duty, in practice, it seems very hard to get money out of wealth taxes. We do, you know, we do have a kind of wealth tax through council tax. It's not a particularly progressive one. And one could perhaps make council tax, which is one of the most important forms of wealth, a bit more progressive by the level going up more with values. But it's a little bit of a rat, but I don't think it's a huge rat.
Thank you to the men of the audience who brought to my attention that actually there are two entries in the index under wealth. I can't say I haven't got my reading glasses on. I just looked at the index carelessly. Just one lecture, two books, and those of you interested in last year's lectures, they're now available. John, I think your book is maybe still outside, but it's not. It's certainly in the bookshop. Thank you very much indeed. The next speaker is Espen Andersen on inequality in Europe in a few weeks' time. The date is on the website. Once again, John, thank you.
Okay, that's fine. Good topic.
Good topic.